Reading from Sports Illustrated, a one-hour reading of sports news. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona, and let's begin today's reading with a feature from this month's Sports Illustrated entitled, Quarterback Landing Spots. How do prospective high draft picks and their helicopter parents decide on the ultimate NFL destination? And this feature written by Sports Illustrated writer Connor Orr. In the days leading up to March 6, 1997, Archie Manning spoke with reporters about his son Peyton Manning and the decision that he had made to eschew the draft and return for his senior season at Tennessee. Archie, according to The Tennessean, took on the role of unbridled advisor, speaking with the head coach and general manager of the team with the number one pick, the New York Jets. He had become schooled in what he called the agent situation and quote-unquote salary caps, and lamented the time that the process was taking away from his golf game. While this feigned naivete lost a bit of its genteel southern charm when Archie was again center stage for his youngest son Eli's refusal to play for the Chargers leading up to the 2004 NFL draft, the precedent for how a parent could intervene in the process and succeed was set. Since that time, Caleb Williams' father, Carl, yanked his son out of NFL combine drills and medical testing ahead of the 2024 draft to avoid anything that could create a harmful narrative surrounding Caleb. Now, ahead of the 2025 draft, it's been impossible to ignore the stream of conscious thoughts from Colorado coach Deion Sanders, whose son Shador is widely considered one of the top quarterback prospects in the draft. Sanders said on the Million Dollars Worth of Game podcast, quote, I know where I want my sons to go. There's certain cities where it ain't going to happen. It's going to be an Eli, unquote. The Mannings could be in the news again next year when Archie's grandson, Arch, figures to be a high first rounder. Throughout the last three decades of parental meddling, these stories are not uncommon. Less common, since most of these snowplow parents end up denying the scope of their involvement once the desired result is achieved, is a full pronouncement of what they wanted for their children in the first place, which makes LeBron James's not-so-subtle efforts to have his son Bronny end up on the Lakers with him kind of refreshing. That begs the question, outside of the obvious, to never play for the Jets or the Browns, which at this point should be considered a basic human right, what is the ideal locale and situation for a young quarterback? What should a parent and a player want? With that very big question in mind, Sports Illustrated posed a prompt to nearly two dozen former pro quarterbacks, current and former NFL coaches and executives. high-level NFL quarterback trainers and agents of quarterbacks. If they had a child poised to be the number one pick but could game the draft in their favor, which team would they choose and why? Each participant was permitted to give three teams as their answer and was granted anonymity so that they could speak more freely on the matter. The results are both a window into the league's current standard bearers and a mirror pointing back towards the sports parent in all of us, as well as a peek into what the future of drafts in every sport could look like for those who possess the clout to manipulate it. Quote, "It's a fundamental question. It's survival," says sports psychologist Jim Taylor, who has written on the intersection of sports and parenting. "It's a different kind of survival in this day and age, but nonetheless, you're ensuring your child's survival in their achievement path. It will increase their chances of, quote-unquote, surviving if they are put with a better team," unquote. The question posed to those in and around the NFL was left intentionally vague in order to help draw out what those connected to the league truly value and how all-encompassing a positive environment for a quarterback really is. For example, many respondents asked if they should consider the current draft order and weigh their responses accordingly, assuming that either the Titans, the Giants, or the Browns, owners of the first three picks in this year's draft, would insist on taking a quarterback. In order to glean more about the NFL, we said no, offering them a kind of unchecked authority over the mechanizations of the draft. Taylor puts most sports parents on a kind of continuum. On one side are those who are acting out of selflessness, and on the other, selfishness. Taylor considers the latter a form of theft and has dealt with countless young prospects whose parents were living out some sort of fantasy through their children, or worse, utilizing their children in a kind of money-making scheme. However, when it comes to highly successful people helping their children succeed in sports, it is often an expression of selflessness, Taylor says. Basically, Archie Manning and LeBron James have already been to the height of their respective professions. They don't need the success of their children to heal a bruised ego or pad a bank account. It's just part of the game, Taylor says. Is it fair? No, because there are other college quarterbacks coming out who don't have that, unquote. This is why the results of the poll are valuable, because all of the respondents have already realized their dreams or are living them currently. The respondents were or are general managers in the NFL, Pro Bowlers, Rookie of the Year award winners, or millionaires who have done some of the largest deals in modern NFL history. While highly unscientific and conducted largely through phone calls and text messages, their responses reflect a sober view of the NFL and what predicates success. It also draws out the complex nature of helicopter parenting at the professional level because so many people have different ideas of what success actually is. In all, 18 teams received votes. The Bears received a kind of honorary vote from one panelist who said that they were intrigued by new head coach Ben Johnson based on his body of work with Jared Goff in Detroit. The Bengals and Zach Taylor, who has molded Joe Burrow, also received a similar vote. Quote, "I default to ownership and the play caller when it comes to quarterback decisions," unquote, said one former quarterback who voted in the poll. Said one respondent who voted for the Cowboys first, noting the prevalence of marketing deals done by Dallas players compared to other franchises, money. said the lone respondent who picked the Titans but was not connected to the franchise in any meaningful way, quote, "It's bad for a young quarterback to be in a big market. See Zach Wilson, the Jets' number two overall draft choice in 2021. A lesser media market is better for a young quarterback. And the new general manager there is good and should get it right," unquote. Said another former quarterback who voted for the Chiefs, Ravens, and Eagles, three teams with elite signal callers, quote, "These teams will do everything to build around the quarterback. They do a great job of meeting the player where he is instead of trying to change the very reason they drafted him. They also have a great culture of having each other's backs from coaches to players. They have an identity, and that's why their quarterbacks flourish," unquote. So clearly, different teams offer different strengths. For example, the Giants evoked a kind of paternal feeling, ensuring that their kid would be cared for personally. The team stuck with Manning through what was a statistically complicated career and padded the runway to his first start by signing veteran Kurt Warner. Though the franchise has lacked recent success and shuffled through a rapid succession of head coaches following the finale of the Tom Coughlin regime, the team has maintained an air of maturity. Daniel Jones, who was drafted as Manning's successor in 2019, made it to a second contract before his release during the 2024 season. The Steelers were clearly a popular pick because of the stability provided by coach Mike Tomlin. The Cowboys offered financial opportunities, providing a safety net for players after the conclusion of careers. The Titans offered precious anonymity and a slice of normalcy, or as much of those two things as a quarterback can enjoy at the NFL level, while strong workplace culture was a factor for other franchises. These wishes are set against the backdrop of an increasingly cutthroat environment, which was brought up by one NFL offensive position coach. Quarterbacks are routinely discarded before the end of their rookie contracts, left to navigate the uncertainty of a second-chance market. In 2020, all four first-round quarterbacks, Joe Burrow, Tua Tagovailoa, Justin Herbert, and Jordan Love, made it to second contracts with their original teams. However, the following year, only one of the five first-rounders, Trevor Lawrence, made it to a second deal. Wilson, Trey Lance, Mac Jones, and Justin Fields were all on different rosters prior to the expiration of their rookie deals. The lone first-round quarterback selected in 2022, Kenny Pickett, was just moved to Cleveland, his third team. While it's too early to offer a judgment on the 2023 class, two of the first three quarterbacks selected, Bryce Young and Anthony Richardson, found themselves benched at some point during the 2024 season, though Young returned from his sabbatical looking better than he ever has at the NFL level. Still, being cast away is not a death sentence for a quarterback. Sometimes it offers the chance to find a team that presents a better situation, a point underscored by the success of late bloomers like Geno Smith, Sam Darnold, and Baker Mayfield, all of whom made their first Pro Bowls after leaving their initial teams. The scariest thing these days are when a young quarterback goes to a bad team with a new head coach, says one NFL offensive position coach. It is difficult to succeed. Quarterbacks need time to develop, and the public and owners just shred them now. The days of time to develop are gone. You have to win now, and the quarterback and head coach are first to get destroyed. Think, if Peyton Manning or Jim Kelly or Troy Aikman had the records that they had to start off in this environment, unquote. With so many different factors determining success and so many different beliefs on how to arrive there, perhaps the biggest surprise in the poll was that there was one clear-cut winner, the Rams. Having a head coach like Sean McVay certainly helps. But perhaps what makes the organization so admired is its ability to understand what all of our respondents seem to emanate individually. When it comes to the most important singular position in American sports, it's all at once more and less complicated than one could imagine. Les Snead maintains a neatly manicured Southern accent from his days growing up in Eufaula, Alabama, and attending college at Auburn. But when it comes to unpacking the Rams as a kind of quarterbacking utopia, the team's GM sounds more like a West Coast real estate agent, sunglasses affixed, cruising down some water-edged freeway in a red convertible. This is a young person's world, and there's an energy, an electricity, an excitement to the city and the location, he says. Our owner built this iconic stadium that, if you're flying into L.A., you can see. If it's on television, you say that that place looks different. And before the commercial, they're showing a scene of the sunset over the Pacific Ocean. Then you come back to the game and you see an urgent Sean McVay coaching, oozing this element of passion and enjoyment. It all compounds, unquote. Snead wants us to envision a Venn diagram in which the quarterback is at a center. Around him are circles involving location, a culture of personal respect and sacrifice for a greater good, and the people who exist within that culture helping the quarterback achieve success. Sean and his staff have proven that they can give the quarterback an edge, Snead says. Sean will often say, "Hey, I'm designing how the sword fighter fights, but the fighter is the one with the sword in his hands." And I think that everyone recognizes that. We are not ranked number one without Sean as our head coach, unquote. Indeed, no other coach was mentioned more than McVay from our respondents. In 11 years as either an offensive play caller or a head coach, McVay's teams have been one of the top 10 units in the NFL in terms of net passing yards per attempt 8 times. His teams have been top 10 in total yards 6 times. Beyond that is a kind of undercurrent of belief that McVay can make an offense work for anyone. One particular flourish on his resume was a 2022 game in which Mayfield, who had been waived by the Panthers on Monday and claimed by the Rams on Tuesday and practiced with the team on Wednesday, proceeded to start for L.A. on Thursday Night Football against the Raiders, orchestrating a game-winning touchdown drive and finishing with a career rating above 90. After that game, Mayfield spoke of McVay's ability to teach a quarterback to quickly adjust to any defensive look that he might face. Quote, "It's pretty special to watch how detailed he is and just getting to know him and how he wants to put guys in good positions," unquote, he said. Snead was speaking of Venn diagrams mere days after Matthew Stafford chose to return to the Rams despite having permission to seek a trade. He had overtures from quarterback-desperate teams, including a chance run-in with Raiders minority owner Tom Brady at a posh ski resort. But Stafford opted not to leave L.A. His backup, Jimmy Garoppolo, also came back to the franchise on a one-year deal despite this offseason's myriad openings. Snead alluded to the fact that beyond mere formalities like interviewing coaches and choosing to sign quarterbacks, there is a quote-unquote deep level of vetting, assessment, and analysis that comes with bringing in the kind of people that help fill out that Venn diagram. Specifically, emotional intelligence was also important that the team thoroughly researched it in candidates, including McVay, whom Snead hired in 2017, even before they reached the formal interview process. Underneath the haze of corpo jargon was an intentional word choice that he kept making throughout the interview, once even correcting himself to do so. At no point did Snead ever use a transactional word to describe the quarterback. The Rams do not sign or extend or draft. Snead prefers the word partner. And perhaps therein lies the heart of the matter. One NFL exec polled for this story, who interviewed for multiple general manager openings this cycle, noted the effectiveness and simplicity in just having a plan for a quarterback and conveying it openly and honestly. A plan that takes into account the quarterback holistically as well as physically. Example, are you looking at offensive tackles who better suit a dropback or a mobile passer? When put that way, the idea of force-feeding a prospect to a certain locale doesn't seem that ridiculous after all. It bypasses the typical NFL cycle of failure in which a team has to become so bad to be in the position to draft a franchise quarterback that there is often little hope that the club can improve enough to actually help a prospect realize his full potential. As one former All-Pro and current NFL analyst put it, quote, if I were Deion Sanders, I would do it too. Why wouldn't I? Unquote. Regardless of what we really want for our children, financial success, statistical success, happiness, or some combination of those things, we want those in charge of their development to treat them with the care that we would. When thanked for sharing a small piece of how the Rams treat the position and informed that the reporter himself was feeling more prepared for understanding the nuances of the topic, Snead asked if he felt like he had enough plays in the playbook calibrated to his strengths. Quote, I expect 3 touchdowns from you, unquote, he said with total confidence. He was kidding, right? Or maybe this is just part of the Rams' experience that everyone is searching for. And again, that feature is entitled Quarterback Landing Spots. How do prospective high picks and their helicopter parents decide on the ultimate NFL destination? Written by Sports Illustrated writer Connor Orr. And in other NFL takeaways, this one's entitled Pump the Brakes on Arch Manning's 2026 Draft Hype. The Texas quarterback with a famous last name is no sure thing to enter the NFL after 1 year as a starter in college. And this feature written by Albert Breer of Sports Illustrated. It's time to stop the madness on Arch Manning. And I'd advise everyone to do what Manning's own family has. Let the kid be what he is right now. That is a college quarterback entering his redshirt sophomore year and his first as the full-time starter at an historic Blue Blood program. Manning got into 2 games during his redshirt season, throwing a total of 5 passes and logging 3 carries, all of which accounted for 37 yards. Last year, he flashed, starting 2 games, getting into 10 and completing 61 of 90 passes for 939 yards, 9 touchdowns, and 2 picks. He also ran for 108 yards and 4 touchdowns on 25 carries, punctuated by a 67-yard touchdown run against University of Texas at San Antonio. He is listed at 6'4" and 225 pounds. He has the pedigree of a grandfather who was drafted with a number 2 pick and 2 uncles who somehow both went even higher than that. I get it. Everyone's excited. You should be. It's a great story. But for now, for NFL teams, that's really all it is. That's not anywhere near enough to go on to know whether he'll be a top 5 pick or a 5th-round pick down the line. Lots of folks thought that Quinn Ewers, whom Manning is succeeding at Texas, was destined to be a 1st-round pick when he became Texas's starter in the year 2022. He went in the 7th round, which is to say, with all due respect, a recruiting ranking and a fun early highlight reel will need to be a precursor to a whole lot more if Manning is going to be drafted as high as the other quarterbacks in his family once were. I get that everyone's excited, one AFC college scouting director told me. That run happened, and people started talking. They're almost surprised with that last name that he has that speed and the ability to generate big plays with his legs, and he gets transformed into this elite prospect. The reality is that we haven't really seen him run the offense with any consistency yet, and that's not his fault. He just hasn't played, unquote. What are we looking at? You'd like to watch a quarterback in double-digit games to really evaluate them. At other positions, you might get a feel after watching 4 games and have a good idea of who a guy is. The quarterback position is much different. It requires a much larger bank of film. You want to see him against a variety of different looks. In college, the talent is not as concentrated, so you want to see him against an Alabama or a Georgia, unquote. In other words, you want to see him after defenses start to game plan for him and against teams that won't be overwhelmed by Texas's array of stars. His 2 starts last year were against Mississippi State, which went 0-8 in the SEC, and University of Texas at San Antonio. Ideally, teams want college quarterbacks to have at least 25 starts, so the volume of things that they have seen is large enough to get a full assessment. You just don't know until they're really playing, said another AFC college scouting director. Quote, right now, the body of work is too small. We've seen big guys with talent, the tools, the arm, that don't know how to process and don't have the accuracy to all levels of the field consistently enough. What we have on Manning isn't nearly enough. You could guess, but that's really all you're going to be doing, guessing, unquote. Again, that's not to say that there isn't a lot of promise here. There is a ton. He's shown plus athleticism, more like his grandfather Archie or his dad Cooper than his uncles Peyton and Eli, and plenty of arm on a frame that is close to the NFL prototype. He's also, as I understand it, a popular figure in the Texas Longhorns program, carrying a swagger and confidence that allows him to connect with teammates from all walks of life. And those teammates were excited to see what he could do when he got in games last year, which is a sign of what he's shown them in practice. His mechanics are sound. The way he sets up in the pocket, he looks like a Manning, said the first college director, and he looks well coached already, which is a start. Then there is the family history, which would make you think, and most NFL people do, that there's very little chance that he'll come out after a single season of starting. Peyton Manning started for 4 years at Tennessee and returned for his senior year, despite the likelihood that he would have gone number one to Bill Parcells' New York Jets in 1997. Eli Manning started 3 years at Ole Miss and came back in 2003, even with a consensus that he was going in the first round that April. All that, by the way, was also without the benefit of NIL money to make staying in college more enticing. As for Arch himself, his dad has done all that he can to keep Arch's trajectory as natural and old school as possible. As a high school recruit, he kept as low a profile as possible, rarely doing interviews or popping up on social media. He had to set up a Twitter account to commit to Texas. 3 years later, it is one of just 5 posts to his name. And his family is aware of the benefit that a quarterback gets in the raw amount of starts that he makes in college ahead of going to the NFL. Even after this year, Manning will be well below that 25-start threshold. So keep Manning first in your 2026 mock drafts if you want. And I'll keep thinking that it is way more likely that we see him in 2027 or 2028. The next NFL quarterback topic is Kirk Cousins. While we're there, options for Kirk Cousins and the Falcons to part ways are dwindling. As we wrote a couple of months ago, there were really 3 quote-unquote deadlines in this saga. March 15th, when a $10 million roster bonus for 2026 would vest as fully guaranteed. Second, from April 24th to April 26th, when the draft would further clarify teams' quarterback depth charts. And finally, late July, when training camps open. Atlanta held on to Kirk Cousins through the first deadline, locking in his $10 million guarantee for next year, which pushes the full guarantee on the contract he signed in 2024 from $90 million to $100 million. Then, last weekend, the Falcons kept Cousins through the second deadline as teams drafted and their rosters grew closer to completion, leaving less space for veteran additions thereafter and more defined pecking orders. Now to review, Cousins met with Atlanta Falcons owner Arthur Blank on the night of March the 5th to plead his case to be released or traded as the start of the league year and the vesting date loomed. After the first wave of free agency passed and the guarantee vested, Cousins got word out to teams that he would use his no-trade clause to block any trade until after the draft because he wanted to avoid another situation like the one he was in last year when the Falcons drafted Michael Penix, number 8, less than 2 months after signing Cousins. So another window opened after the first round of the draft, and there wasn't much action on him. The Pittsburgh Steelers are still waiting for Aaron Rodgers. The Minnesota Vikings were only going to consider a reunion at this point if the Falcons ate a big chunk of his salary. And, absent that, Minnesota traded for a much deeper alternative in Sam Howell in the draft's third day. The Cleveland Browns put a 4th quarterback on their roster in the 3rd round and a 5th quarterback in the 5th round. That leaves Kirk Cousins without a logical destination, and the Falcons with a rather expensive second-string quarterback who is now guaranteed $27.5 million in base salary for this year. Realistically, at this point, it seems like the 2 possible exit doors for Kirk Cousins open if the Steelers don't land Rodgers or another quarterback that's hurt somewhere. But even if there's an injury, it would have to happen before the trade deadline. And there's a chance that Kirk Cousins wouldn't want to uproot his family and could thus block a trade if he doesn't like the destination. The next name among NFL current topics is Bill Belichick. There were lots of judgments made and jokes told last week about Bill Belichick, and I do think in the end it will have an impact on his ability to return to the NFL. We've all seen his contract. The buyout for an NFL team to pry him from North Carolina drops from $10 million to $1 million less than 4 weeks from now. That more or less reads like an invitation for the pros to try to poach him back from college football in the year 2026. Whether the pros accept that invitation is another story. And if you ask me now what the last week or so did to affect that, I would say the equation in an owner's head may have been altered a little bit, or maybe more than just a little bit. When you hire a coach, you take everything that comes with it into account. If you look, then, at what's happening at the University of North Carolina, you'll see that the school has taken on a lot of non-football water, what Belichick might have categorized as quote-unquote distractions in the past, over the first 5 months of his employment. Yes, that can be washed away to a degree with wins, but the chance to get those is still 4 months away. So the University of North Carolina, which, by the way, has a lot of powerful academics who don't care if the ball is puffed or stuffed and don't view football success as a priority, will have to get through 9 months of this stuff for, they hope, maybe 3 or 4 years of winning. And if the Tar Heels win, the question of Belichick returning to the NFL will arise again. The math in the NFL then would not be far off from what the University of North Carolina is dealing with. In other words, an owner would have to decide whether he or she would want to take on 8 months of everything that comes with the greatest coach ever just to get that first win and maybe 2 or 3 seasons of having him on the sideline. Remember, the second Belichick is hired, he'll become the face of whatever franchise he is joining. It is complicated. Some teams will decide, like I think a couple did in January, to take easier, cheaper, more conventional routes. I have long thought an owner looking for credibility would take a real swing at landing Belichick in 2026, but I'm not nearly as sure about that anymore. Yes, it is a free country. Belichick can do what he wants. But we saw 4 years of what he looked like in the NFL without Tom Brady, and now we've seen half a year of what he looks like stripped of the infrastructure he worked so hard to build in Foxborough a quarter century ago. To me, that's as relevant to his future as, and maybe more so, than whom he is dating. Essentially, it's not that he's with a 24-year-old, it's what he's put her in charge of. And the next NFL topic is the Tennessee Titans. I'm optimistic about where the Tennessee Titans are headed and what they're going to put around Cam Ward in the fall. And that's in part because I think being so ahead on the quarterback assessments bought them time in the end to focus on everything else that they wanted to accomplish in their first draft with general manager Mike Bergonzi and a reshaped front office in place. I think 2 picks from last weekend in particular can illustrate that. The first was Penn State safety Kevin Winston Jr. His final season as a Nittany Lion ended in September with a partial tear to his ACL leading to surgery. it caused teams to back off him a bit, which is understandable. But the Titans had him at the top of the second round, grade-wise, as a guy with the size and strength to play close to the line, and speed and range to play deep. They could feel his impact on tape. Raw speed was a question. He wasn't ready to run at the combine, but weeks later, at his first pro day, just 6 months out of surgery, he clocked at 4.5 in the 40-yard dash for the scouts on hand, which showed his rehab was going well, his determination to show the NFL people what he had, and also the potential that he was actually a little bit faster than that. The Titans got him with the 82nd pick. Then there was Texas tight end Gunnar Helm, a hyper-productive weapon in a star-studded group of skill players. The 4.84 that Helm ran in Indy cratered his stock. But digging deeper, you would see that on his first try, he had a false start, and as he pivoted back to the line, he badly sprained his ankle. He gutted it out and ran his 2.40s, albeit much slower than he would have liked, and afterward his ankle was black and blue all over. At Pro Day, because of the ankle, he didn't attempt another 40, but fought through drills. The Titans snapped him up with the 120th pick. So if you figure that Tennessee got these two guys around later than maybe they should have gone because of injuries that are now healing up, allowing for them to play roles as rookies, then the Titans did some really good work here. And in one more takeaway from this past NFL draft, prank calls. The prank call situation is pretty wild. So here's what I would say. My opinion has changed a little bit on this. I still think that demonizing a 20-year-old for being a knucklehead is a bit much. But as for now, this sort of information gets out after digging around, I do understand why the league is taking it so seriously and trying to create deterrence for people with access. This week, the league fined the Atlanta Falcons $250,000 and their defensive coordinator, Jeff Ulbrich, $100,000 after Ulbrich's college-age son prank-called Shedeur Sanders, pretending to be New Orleans Saints general manager Mickey Loomis on draft weekend. The revelation of the call, which got out through Sanders' social media, sparked a bevy of other players in the draft saying that they had been pranked too. So clearly this wasn't just an isolated issue. But there are different ways that the different cases are happening. In Sanders' case, the call did result from the league sending out a list of numbers of 39 players who would be participating in the draft TV show on NFL Network and ESPN, 15 of whom would be in Green Bay, and the other 24 coming on remotely. That list went to the waiver wire list, and it's up to teams to determine who gets the daily waiver report. It's not unusual for a team to have a fairly large group of coaches and personnel folks getting the waivers because it is relevant to a lot of people's jobs. Anyway, some of the other prank calls happened to players who weren't on that list, and of course, there are plenty of ways for numbers to get circulated. So as much as the NFL looks into this, and they're still digging into and investigating all of these cases, there's always going to be an element that they cannot control as long as they do things this way. That's why I would expect teams and the league to continue to discuss other ways to do draft calls going forward. And again, that's not because we're talking about capital crimes here. More so, as I see it anyway, it would be to save everyone this unnecessary aggravation. And again, that Sports Illustrated online feature is entitled NFL Takeaways: Pump the Brakes on Arch Manning's 2026 Draft Hype, written by Sports Illustrated writer Albert Breer. And from NFL news, let's turn now to some NBA news. The next headline reads, "The matchup that will decide each NBA playoff second-round series." Superstars take center stage in the conference semifinals round of the postseason, headlined by a monster matchup of Nikola Jokic versus Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. In this feature, written by Sports Illustrated writer Liam McEwen. The NBA playoffs are so often determined by individual matchups. Superstar versus superstar, player versus scheme, coaching style versus coaching style. It all ultimately leads to glorious victory or devastating defeat for the whole organization. But the path to both destinations is littered with individual victories and losses. Talent matters, of course, but after a certain point, everybody left in the postseason field is talented. The series is then determined by those individual battles. Take the first round as an example. The Minnesota Timberwolves took down the Los Angeles Lakers in 5 games, in part because Anthony Edwards solved a confusing defensive scheme from J.J. Redick. Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown went toe-to-toe with Paolo Banchero and Franz Wagner to move on to the second round. And Steve Kerr managed to outmaneuver Ime Udoka's excellent defensive design to get the Golden State Warriors past the Houston Rockets. The second round promises to be more of the same. Here are the matchups that will determine every series as the NBA postseason enters conference semifinals play. First matchup, number 1 seed Oklahoma City versus number 4 seed Denver. The matchup to watch is Nikola Jokic versus Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Gilgeous-Alexander and Jokic were far and away the two best players in the NBA this season. They will undoubtedly finish neck and neck for this season's MVP award. Now their respective teams will do battle in the postseason. There isn't much more fans could ask for. While they will spend little time guarding each other one-on-one, this is still the most enticing matchup of the second round. Gilgeous-Alexander, or SGA, led the Thunder to 68 wins, and after such an easy, swift first-round sweep, they will have been sitting at home for over a week by the time Game 1 tips off Monday night. Meanwhile, Jokic guided the Nuggets through a tumultuous end-of-season coaching change and a fierce 7-game series against the Los Angeles Clippers in the first round. And even after moving on to the second round, it is clear that both stars have more to give. Gilgeous-Alexander shot over 50% from the field in only one of his first 4 playoff games this postseason. It took until Game 4 for the shifty guard to eclipse his 32.7 points per game average against the Memphis Grizzlies. The Clippers put together a tremendous defensive game plan for Jokic, and while the Serbian superstar got his stats, he didn't comfortably dominate in the way that we're used to seeing. The 3-time MVP managed only 16 or fewer shots in 4 of 7 games against Los Angeles, well below his season average of 19.5 shots per game. Jokic, perhaps more than any player in league history, doesn't need to get shots up to control the game, but it serves as a reflection of the Clippers' quality defensive scheme. In the big picture of this series, the Thunder have better depth, while the Denver Nuggets have championship metal. But the upcoming duel between two of the greatest players in the world makes for must-watch TV. And in another NBA playoff matchup, number 6 seed Minnesota Timberwolves versus number 7 seed Golden State Warriors. The matchup to watch, Anthony Edwards versus double teams. Throughout this NBA season, Edwards has been forced to deal with the special treatment that all great scorers get from opposing defenses, a healthy dosage of double teams and swarming coverages. He didn't adjust well initially and even went so far as to complain that he doesn't want to pass the ball all the time earlier in the year. But the superstar has slowly adjusted, and his growth was on full display in the Timberwolves' dominant first-round series win over the Los Angeles Lakers. Without a top-tier wing defender to throw at Edwards, Redick installed a variety of coverages to prevent Minnesota's star from catching any sort of rhythm, with the one common factor being Edwards nearly always had two defenders right in his grill. Los Angeles swarmed him every single time he touched the ball and was more than willing to live with the Wolves regularly attacking 4-on-5 as a result. The Lakers accomplished their primary goal. Edwards exploded in only one game, a 43-point romp in Game 4, but otherwise was held to inefficient shooting numbers and fairly limited scoring output. The problem that led to LA's elimination was that he figured out how best to deal with those double teams. In every Minnesota win, Edwards recorded at least 6 assists. In the one loss that the team suffered, he had 0 assists. The Warriors seem likely to enact a similar strategy. They are far better equipped to do so with several dangerous defenders littering the starting lineup. And while Edwards has shown that he can dice up defenses, he also hasn't yet shown the ability to score consistently in those scenarios. How Edwards adjusts to double teams featuring Jimmy Butler and Draymond Green instead of Luka Doncic and Austin Reeves will determine the path of this series. If he and the rest of the Timberwolves' offense show that they can consistently take advantage of the floor imbalance caused by constant double teams, the Warriors will have to find another strategy. But if they can fluster Edwards with the strategy, as he has been at times this season, the series becomes much more interesting. And for the series between number 2 seed Boston Celtics versus number 3 seed New York Knicks, the matchup to watch, Jason Tatum versus Mikal Bridges. After watching the Celtics stroll to a title last year, the New York Knicks spent their offseason playing copycat in an effort to both copy what Boston did best and construct a team capable of defending the many weapons that the defending champions boast. This vision was headlined by the acquisition of Bridges for the high price of 5 first-round picks. Now the Knicks have both what they wanted and what they prepared for, a postseason battle with the Celtics. And Bridges will be pivotal in their efforts to stifle the offensive excellence of Tatum. And in the series between number 1 seed Cleveland Cavaliers versus number 4 seed Indiana Pacers, the matchup to watch is Donovan Mitchell versus Tyrese Haliburton. It isn't revolutionary to point to two of the top scorers in the series and say that their duel will determine how things go. But for these two teams, it's just that simple. Mitchell and Haliburton are conductors of their respective orchestras, a pair of lightning-in-a-bottle offensive players whose teams follow their leads. Both are also questionable defensively, which means that their ability to push their teams will largely be determined by their offensive output. We've already seen that reflected on the court. Game 1, the Pacers stole home court from the Cavaliers, winning 121-112. Halliburton was nearly immaculate, posting 22 points and 13 assists with only one turnover, as he regularly led the Pacers' offense into transition at every opportunity. He kept the Cavs' defense on its toes all night, and when he can hit his step-back threes in isolation, it's basically impossible to defend him. For most of the game, it felt like Halliburton dictated the state of play, not Cleveland's defense. That is a losing formula for the number one seeded Cavs. Mitchell, on the other hand, did not have his best stuff. Missing co-star Darius Garland, the All-Star scorer put up 33 points on 30 shots, featuring a disastrous 1 out of 11 showing from beyond the arc. The Cavaliers were outscored by 19 points in his 34 minutes on the court. And again, that Sports Illustrated feature is entitled The Matchup That Will Decide Each NBA Playoff Second Round Series, written by Liam McConey of Sports Illustrated. And that's all the time that we have for this reading of Sports Illustrated.
My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of Sports Illustrated. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info. And you could hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.